From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. States across the country are reinstating or ratcheting up coronavirus restrictions on businesses, schools, and social gatherings as new COVID-19 infections spread at the fastest rate since the pandemic began. California's Governor Gavin Newsom said Monday he was pulling the emergency brake on much of the state's reopening, just as that state set a single-day record for new cases. Republican-led states like Iowa and Oklahoma have imposed new restrictions. Iowa's governor reversed course to assure a new statewide mask mandate.
And in Michigan, Governor Gretchen Whitmer announced a three-week stay-at-home order in that state, saying, quote, "The situation has never been more dire." We're going to check in shortly in Texas and New Jersey, but first let's bring in Dustin Dwyer. He's a reporter at Michigan Radio, and he's in Grand Rapids. Welcome, Dustin.
Thank you.
Governor Whitmer said Sunday that Michigan is in the worst moment of this pandemic to date. Just how bad is it there? And what does this new order beginning Wednesday mean for Michiganders?
Well, it is really bad here in Michigan, and it's not as if Michigan had an easy time in the spring. Detroit was one of the hardest hit cities in the country back then. Thousands of people died. But back then, most of the rest of the state in Michigan, we didn't see too many cases. Where I live in Grand Rapids, it was relatively calm. And that's what's changed now. Basically, the entire rest of the state is seeing cases like it hasn't seen at any time in this pandemic. The state as a whole is now averaging more than 6,000 new cases a day. There are more than 3,500 people in the hospital. We expect at the current trajectory, that'll be a peak. By the end of this week, we'll have more people in the hospital than ever during this pandemic. And what's really frightening is that by the time the hospitalizations turned in the spring, there had already been a lockdown in place and new cases had already started falling. We haven't seen that yet. And so now this new order, which takes effect at midnight, it's going to close all indoor dining. It will stop in-person instructions for high schools, colleges, and universities. And the state also now wants people to limit their indoor social gatherings to no more than 10 people. And they say that should include people from no more than two households, which is important because a lot of public health people have been saying that the virus has been spreading actually in a lot of small indoor gatherings, just between a few people.
Yeah, and we're coming up on the holidays. Governor Whitmer is a Democrat and has faced backlash for her coronavirus restrictions in the past. Earlier this year, folks may remember the FBI arrested a group of men accused of trying to kidnap her. How are people in Michigan reacting to this latest announcement? And I have only 30 seconds with you.
Yeah, the people who opposed the restrictions in the past are really still opposed to them. But there are a lot of people who support these restrictions and who will abide by them this time.
That's Dustin Dwyer. He's a reporter with Michigan Radio in Grand Rapids. Thank you for this update.
Thank you.
Let's go to Texas, where officials have given no indication they're considering the kinds of restrictions we're seeing in other states, even as Texas counted more than 20,000 deaths as of Monday. El Paso, the border city with 680,000 people, now has more people hospitalized with COVID-19 than many states. Here's traveling nurse Lawana Rivers in El Paso talking about the University Medical Center there in a Facebook video a few days ago.
So I saw a lot of people die that I feel like shouldn't have died. Y'all, that assignment there broke me. I was put in what's called a pit. And in this pit was eight patients, all COVID positive. My first day of orientation, I was told that whatever patients go into the pit, they only come out in a body bag.
Now, University Medical Center officials said they couldn't verify those claims. But let's bring in Bonnie Petrie, a reporter for Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Bonnie, start with El Paso. Inmates from the county's detention facility are reportedly being paid $2 an hour to help move bodies to morgue units. You know, what's being done to help El Paso?
Well, it's tough right now. You know, it's overwhelmed right now. We talked this week to a funeral director who had to turn one of his chapels into a morgue, put refrigerators in the chapel because he just didn't have room for the dead anymore. And that's in addition to the mobile morgues you were talking about. And the state has sent in extra healthcare workers. Air Force medical teams have been sent in. But as the surge submerges the entire nation, the entire state, and the entire nation, there will be fewer resources to go around, of course.
Right. They can't help each other. Well, Texas has more than a million cases. That's the second highest count in the country after New York. Second highest death count in Texas. You know, what are public officials saying about, you know, how this happened and how to stop it?
Yeah, so that's the question, right? So people let their guard down, essentially. It's pretty easy to track mathematically. When back in March, after the nationwide stay-at-home orders the governor started phasing reopening in May, case counts started to rise. And before you know it, we had that summer surge that was so hard. Then the governor instituted a mask mandate in June, and it slowed the spread. It slowed the rise of cases, and they started to decrease and stabilize. Then, you know, schools, some of them opened in-person instruction. Many colleges did. Then we had contact sports and other activities. Halloween, case counts started to rise again. And in rural parts of the state that had avoided the first surge altogether, they started to get hammered. And now many people in rural areas just wouldn't mask up at all or take other precautions. So that's pretty much how we ended up where we are.
Well, I mean, is there a demand that there be change? We know your governor, the Republican Greg Abbott, said there wouldn't be any new lockdowns. Lockdowns is a treacherous word. There have been hardly any lockdowns in the U.S. It's mostly stay at home, you know, and go out for food and stuff. But even no stay at home?
Well, the reactions are mixed to those. You know, even in cities like El Paso that are so overwhelmed right now, the county judge there, who's the highest elected official in the county, like a county executive, ordered a shutdown to try to a stay-at-home order to try to stem the rising tide of infections and take some of the weight off the hospitals. But the mayor said, heck no, we're not doing that. Mm. No shutdown. And then El Paso Business Organization said, no way, too. Small business owners, of course, are afraid of losing everything and bargaining assistance from the federal government, which doesn't seem to be forthcoming. People need to work, but they're also afraid of getting sick. And as far as the governor and the attorney general goes, the state fought that stay-at-home order, but the county has been allowed to keep it, and it will remain in effect until December 1st, because they're just trying to get a handle on things before the holidays.
Yeah, well, we'll stay tuned. Bonnie Petrie, reporter for Texas Public Radio, thank you.
Thank you.
And now let's go to the Northeast, where New York Governor Andrew Cuomo held a summit of governors over the weekend to coordinate a regional response. Attendees included New Jersey's governor, whose stricter restrictions on indoor gatherings went into effect today. Joe Hernandez reports on New Jersey state government for WHYY and WBGO. And Joe, New York and New Jersey, we remember, they were the major hotspots early on. They took fierce action, saw numbers fall, then people began to gather indoors. So how bad is this resurgence in New Jersey?
Well, the resurgence is bad in terms of cases. I mean, we're having some of the highest single daily case counts since the spring, some of the highest period. But, you know, part of the reason for that is that there's more testing now, so we probably know about more infections. And also, deaths and hospitalizations haven't risen to the same levels that they were in the spring. But officials are still worried about what's happening. They're lowering limits on indoor and outdoor gatherings. They're letting some towns and counties put in stricter restrictions. But schools are still operating. They're largely getting to choose whether or not they stay open.
Talk about Governor Cuomo's weekend summit. We know Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker's office said he had a scheduling conflict. He couldn't attend, but other New England governors didn't attend either. It kind of signals this may be difficult to bring all these governors of the whole region together. But what was the purpose?
Well, this was a, I guess, private summit or call, whatever, what have you. This was with the governors of New York, as you mentioned, New Jersey, Delaware, Pennsylvania, and Connecticut. And the purpose just seems to be to get a handle on what's going on in these states. I mean, every state basically is seeing a rise in cases. And in the Northeast, at least in the early days of the pandemic, there was some effort to kind of coordinate the response on a regional level. And they were able to do that when it was, we're talking about businesses and things like that. Mm-hmm. If you close bars at the same time in neighboring states, nobody's going to drive across the border to try to have a drink later in the night. But now that private gatherings are what's driving the new cases, it's a little bit harder to do that. You can't shut down the border and you can't really be in people's houses policing what they're doing.
Yeah, well, in just about the minute we have, you know, as far as travel advisories, you know, it depends on who's doing better. At one time, you had to quarantine or stay inside for 2 weeks. If you went from Rhode Island to Massachusetts, then it flipped, and there was also a New York to Rhode Island. And this is one of the most traveled corridors in the world. Is there a sense that with Thanksgiving company, look at you in New Jersey, half your state lives in New York and vice versa, you know, is in work in one place, live in another. Is it going to be hard at Thanksgiving to keep people from pouring over borders?
I mean, I think the short answer is yes. There's no way to close the borders. I mean, we talk about these as different states, but basically you can move freely however you want. So as you mentioned, these quarantine advisories are kind of all over the place. They're often voluntary, so it's again, hard to enforce. And in New Jersey, at least, I think there's some recognition that people are going to gather on Thanksgiving. So while they're trying to dissuade people from doing that, they're also telling them how to do it safely.
Yeah. By the way, later in the program, we're going to look at where the hot spots are emerging through, you know, thermometer readings. And a lot of them are in the region, you know, the counties out on Long Island in New York. So I'm sure New Jersey is also bracing for that as well. Joe Hernandez is a New Jersey state government reporter for WHYY and BGO. Thank you so much, Joe.
You got it.
U.S. Postal Service workers are holding a national day of action today in cities throughout the country, calling for more support from Congress. The service experienced one of its greatest challenges, shepherding millions of presidential mail-in ballots while under political, financial, and operational challenges only amplified by the pandemic. In a few minutes, we'll speak with the head of the American Postal Workers Union about the future of the USPS. But first, I want to bring in Lori Cash, who's a sales and distribution clerk at a local post office in Lancaster, New York. For more on morale from her point of view as the holiday rush gets underway, Lori, welcome.
Thank you so much, Tanya, for having me today.
Absolutely. So you're the president of the APWU's Western New York Area Local. You've worked for the Postal Service for 22 years. How hectic is your job right now?
This year has been definitely the most hectic that we've had. We've been through quite a few challenges, starting with the pandemic. And then we went into election season, which, you know, from, you know, seeing it all over the media, we were kind of a target for the president, who wanted to definitely discredit mail-in voting and make the Postal Service seem like we couldn't handle the amount of ballots that we were going to have this year. But we definitely handled them. We delivered. But yeah, this year was a roller coaster.
A roller coaster year. But I want to know a little bit more about you. You've worked in person throughout this pandemic, and your day starts early, middle of the night early. Give us a snapshot of your job and how it has changed in recent months.
Sure. My job, I start at 2:30 in the morning. I open the building. I meet the truck drivers there that drop off the mail, the Amazon drivers, the UPS drivers, the FedEx drivers. And I bring all the mail in the morning, separate it out into the areas where we sort. We have an area in the post office where we sort all of our packages, which right now is our highest volume. We have an area where we sort all of our letter mail, and then we have an area where we sort all of our flat mail, which is large envelopes, periodicals, magazines, that kind of thing. So my job in the morning is to bring all the mail in and then start separating it by carrier so that when the carriers come in, all the mail for their route is ready for the day for them to take out and deliver.
How stressful is all of this during this time of COVID-19 when cases are surging?
The COVID is scary. It was very scary in the beginning when there were so many unknowns. And I should say we still have a lot of unknowns. And me personally, when I came home, because I live with my husband and my daughter was living with me at the time, she's a teacher, so she was teaching remotely. Mm-hmm. And my mom lives with me as well. So to be extra cautious, I would come home from work every day, take my clothes off, throw them right into the washing machine, go into the shower, make sure that I was, you know, just completely sanitized myself before I even said hello to anybody. I wouldn't even touch the dogs. So it's a scary situation. And now that we're seeing a surge again, I'm starting to feel that, you know, that anxiousness again, you know, when I'm driving into work in the morning, you know, just wondering, you know, what notifications I'm going to get that day of how many new cases we have in the district and where the cases are. And you know, and it's stressful as an employee, but it's also stressful as a local president, too, because I want to keep my employees safe, keep everybody safe, you know, and also keep them updated on all the information going on so that everyone knows what's happening and knows how fast it's spreading and takes it as seriously as I do.
You laid out for us in the beginning of our conversation basically the roller coaster that you and all of your colleagues have actually been on this year. As I mentioned, today is a National Day of Action for Workers. They're calling for more support from Congress. What is your biggest concern right now and call to action for government officials to assist the Postal Service in moving forward?
My biggest concern right now is trying to get a stimulus passed through to make sure that the Postal Service stays solvent. We're not sure what's coming up in the upcoming months. We have more and more employees that are quarantined and are out on COVID leave. So that's more expense that the Postal Service is going to have to pay those employees. They're also going to have to hire replacements and pay those employees. We're going to, if businesses start to shut down, we're going to have a drop in our letter and our flat mail again. So we will be losing losing revenue there. And I am very concerned that without a stimulus, even though I know the Postmaster General said that we have funds to carry us through until next year, I am concerned that without a stimulus for the Postal Service, that we may not be able to be, you know, sustainable past the new year with everything happening with COVID. It's a very scary time right now, and that's probably the biggest thing affecting the Postal Service. My other concern is obviously the changes. You know, Postmaster DeJoy has already put out his plan that he's going to make his operational changes again, which are ultimately going to slow down the mail. And if we slow down the mail, then obviously that's going to make it more difficult on our customers. We're going to start to lose consumer confidence again. And unfortunately, we're going to lose business over that. So if he makes these changes in transportation and delivery times, and we start to lose revenue that way, that's just another financial hit that we're going to take. And we just honestly can't afford to take any more right now without some kind of financial help from Congress.
How does it feel, though, to be recognized for your work by everyday people? I know that you've received an outpouring of support from your community in light of all that the Postal Service is going through.
Oh, we have. And it is so heartwarming to have customers come in and just say thank you. I'll have somebody come in and just say, I just want you to know I bought a book of stamps. I just went and bought a book of stamps. We're going to help you guys. And people have been coming in and bringing us gift cards for coffee because they know we're working longer hours. I've been out in stores and I wear an American Postal Workers Union face mask normally. And people see that it's a postal mask, and I've had just people in stores thank me for the work that I do just by noticing the face mask that I'm wearing. And it's very heartwarming to know that people recognize us now for all the work that we do, because we are just, you know, we're a household name. We're something that everyone takes for granted normally. You know, the Postal Service is just something that's always there, you know. So to kind of stand out now and have people appreciate it really is a wonderful feeling.
Lori Cash is a sales and distribution clerk for the U.S. Postal Service in Lancaster, New York. Best wishes to you, Lori, and thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
You too. Let's turn now to Mark Demenstein for the bigger picture on the future of the U.S. Postal Service. He is president of the American Postal Workers Union, and he joins us via Skype. Mark, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
What are the demands for this National Day of Action?
Well, we have one immediate demand, and that is that the COVID economic negative impact on the post office is dire. It needs to be addressed. Congress has tried in some previous COVID stimulus packages to provide $25 billion in COVID relief. I remind the listeners that the post office does not normally run on tax dollars, so the revenue loss that's projected with COVID is going to make it impossible for the post office to have enough money to carry out its mission. We are asking people to call Congress and call their senators in particular, advocating that they provide the $25 billion of stimulus COVID relief to the United States Postal Service. The other demand is that we want this new Postmaster General, Louis DeJoy, to learn something from the positive, successful movement of mail ballots. We can do this, but it needs to be everybody's mail day in and day out, not just election ballots, as vital as they are, as proud as we were to move that mail and provide that civic duty, and not just till November 3rd, which is now over. We have more elections. We have medicines for veterans and seniors. We have financial transactions. We have e-commerce. And the people of this country are promised under the law reliable, efficient services. So the demand is to reverse the negative policies that are slowing down the mail, and let's get the post office back on track and do that much more for the people of the country.
Reverse those policies, but Postmaster General DeJoy has signaled changes coming to the Postal Service in the future, a net loss of $9.2 billion in 2020. You laid out very clearly that what you're asking for is funding to actually help the Postal Service to continue its mission. How would you describe, though, the political situation swirling around the USPS now that President-elect Joe Biden will inherit all of this when he takes office in January?
We still are facing the same Postmaster General who's not hired or fired by the president. We still have the Postal Board of Governors that's in place. But the people of this country have spoken loud and clear that they want the Postal Service to thrive and to continue to do well by the people of the country. So we are optimistic going into the new year, but we have some challenges.
Protecting the integrity of mail-in voting is something you're continuing to fight for. We have ahead of us the Senate runoff races just around the corner in January in Georgia. What are your concerns there?
So I think that our concerns are that because of the public outcry, the Postal Service did the right thing on vote by mail. And we want to make sure that that attention is still paid to Georgia. We had a lot of joint efforts between the unions and management and the workers to make sure those ballots, and let me be very clear, on a nonpartisan basis, we didn't care how people voted in those ballots. We cared that that was the person's right to vote. So we gave it the priority it needed, and we certainly hope that that will carry forward into Georgia.
Mark Demenstein is president of the American Postal Workers Union. Thank you so much, Mark.
Thank you.
Support for Here and Now and the following message is brought to you by the New England Innovation Academy, an innovative engine for students in grades 6 through 12, the first middle and high school that prepares innovators to shape the world through human-centered design. Part world school, part incubator, teaching the cultural dexterity and global focus this era demands. To learn more, visit neiacademy.org.
Many in Washington, D.C. have long wanted to become the nation's 51st state, and some are pinning their hopes on the next Congress. Michaela LaFrack of member station WAMU reports.
Three things need to happen for Washington, D.C. to become a state. First, a statehood bill needs to pass the U.S. House of Representatives. That one's already done. Check.
H.R. 51, a bill to provide for the admission of the state of Washington, D.C. into the Union.
Ms. Spear will vote yay.
The House passed a statehood bill in June for the first time in history. Next, the Senate needs to do the same thing. Then the president must sign off on the whole package. With Democrat Joe Biden the president-elect, that last bit wouldn't be a problem.
I certainly think he will be an advocate.
That's Washington, D.C.'s delegate to Congress, Eleanor Holmes Norton. She explains Biden, like pretty much every elected Democrat, is now on board with statehood. That's because if D.C. becomes a state, its residents would likely elect Democrats to Congress. But before a bill gets to Biden's desk, it needs to pass the House again, and then the Senate. Norton says that's the part that's not looking so good.
The Senate looks like it will continue to be an obstruction.
With two seats in Georgia still up in the air, it's still not clear which party is going to control the new Senate. But even if Democrats win a slim majority, they still won't have enough votes to pass a statehood bill. That's because the statehood bill would need 60 yes votes to pass, and it's unlikely any Republicans would vote for it. Bo Schuff runs the statehood advocacy organization DC Vote. He admits he and his team were disappointed that Democrats didn't take more seats so statehood could move forward.
So that's what the excitement was about, was that maybe that window was going to open earlier than we thought it was going to open. But we have a program and we're ready to go with it.
He says their original plans actually hinge on the next election cycle, not this one. A few years ago, his team looked at all the senators up for re-election, and they realized that statehood-friendly candidates could win a bunch of Senate seats in 2022.
The class of senators that is up for re-election in 2022 is more conducive to statehood-friendly members winning than is the class of 2020.
Meanwhile, some lawyers are trying a completely different route. There's a lawsuit right now that argues it's unconstitutional for district residents to not have full voting representation in Congress. A federal court ruled against the D.C. residents, but the lawyers are filing an appeal with the U.S. Supreme Court. Walter Smith runs D.C. Appleseed, one of the legal organizations involved in the lawsuit. He spoke about it recently on WAMU's Kojo Namdi show.
I think having the lawsuit pending works hand in hand with the statehood movement, because both the lawsuit and the statehood bill bring visibility to our lack of democracy and gives us two ways to get there.
Even with a conservative Supreme Court, Smith insists there's a chance it would rule in D.C.'s favor. Meanwhile, Delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton is going to keep making statehood an issue in Congress, even if the Senate or President-elect Biden don't make it a priority.
It's not going to be at the top of the list now, but we'll make very substantial progress.
Norton's about to start her 30th year in Congress. Even with all the setbacks and the lingering uncertainties, this past year has made her feel more hopeful than ever about D.C. someday becoming the 51st state.
Well, there's nothing like passing a statehood bill for the first time to make you feel energized. So I'm feeling very good about 2021.
For Here and Now, I'm Michaela LaFrac in Washington, D.C.
What is going on in the U.S. Chamber of Commerce? The U.S. Chamber isn't the same as your local Chamber of Commerce, which local businesses join to further local interests, although many also join the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, along with big corporations and business leaders, making it the largest national lobbying group in the country, historically right-leaning and spending millions in support of business-friendly Republican candidates. Which is why their recent video made heads snap. It tells businesses they can beat the pandemic by following the science.
First, masks are key, along with social distancing and hand washing. Mandating masks in public spaces is a unifying theme, and meaningful enforcement is absolutely essential.
That's Marjorie Chorlins, Senior Vice President for European Affairs at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which is not only backing science, it recently backed Democratic members of Congress. Suzanne Clark has been president of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce for about a year and a half, and that's also new. She's the first female president of the chamber. Suzanne, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me.
And you know there are those who are thinking, you know, social distancing and wearing masks is not pro-business because people may not go to businesses when they're thinking there is a pandemic. You say what?
We say we're not going to get back to work until we get back to health. We say you shouldn't have to make a choice between public health and jobs. But that means we have to take the steps that we know work, wearing masks, flu shots, social distancing, and washing your hands.
Well, back in July, your CEO and several business leaders sent a joint letter to President Trump, Vice President Pence, and the National Governors Association. It reads in part, the medical evidence is clear. The wearing of masks or face coverings in public settings, especially when it's not possible to consistently maintain social distancing, is a critical element in preventing the spread of COVID-19, what you just said, and then requested that, you know, maybe everyone work together. Did you get a response?
Yes, we have worked with this administration. We have worked with the Congress, but we will continue to push for a national mask standard that's implemented at the local level based on conditions, but that really urges government officials to get the word out there that masks work. People have a vision of the U.S. chamber as being with one party or the other, but the truth is we're not. We are for job creators and people who wake up in their communities and want their communities to be successful. And health is a really big part of that. Anything that furthers health.
You are nonpartisan. In other words, you don't declare an alignment. But traditionally, the chamber has been supportive of Republican candidates. It was shocking, it sounds like, to members that the chamber endorsed nearly two dozen Democratic candidates for re-election in the last election. Politico reports the state chamber president of Oklahoma wrote complaining Representative Kendra Horn, for instance, was not an appropriate pick for the chamber. She was anti-Big Oil, which is a huge employer in Oklahoma. He wrote, "I'm also concerned the chamber would endorse a congresswoman who voted in lockstep with Nancy Pelosi and other Democrats who are not pro-business." Why would the U.S. Chambers of Commerce endorse somebody like the Democrat Kendra Horn?
So over the past several years, we've worked really hard to strengthen the chamber for the future. And part of that has meant working to broaden our relationships to advance what we see as a pro-business agenda. And when we looked at the scorecard last year of how they voted, a number of Democrats had really stepped up on our priorities, particularly getting USMCA passed with massive bipartisan support. And so for us, when a number of both House Republicans and House Democrats stood for job creators and their priorities, then we're going to stand with them at the end.
That's the Mexico-Canada trade deal you were talking about. But this idea of just even backing Democratic candidates and backing science, which this administration does not, is there a shift?
I think we have really tried over the past couple of years to make getting more people at the job creator table a priority and supporting the people who are there. And so I think we have made it more of a priority to broaden a governing coalition. Look, we had a historic turnout in this election, and we think it's because people want people to govern, not act like bullies and mean girls on the playground. We're fed up with these small businesses that are suffering, these families that are suffering, and we want government to come together and do their jobs, get pandemic relief done, work on an infrastructure bill, and we will work with anyone who wants to work with us on those priorities.
Well, what else would you back? You know that Dr. Michael Osterholm, who is one of President-elect Biden's coronavirus advisory board members, said that a stay-at-home order, a national stay-at-home order, at least in many parts of the country, may be necessary, but the government should pay workers to stay home for up to 6 weeks. And that would go so far in curbing the spread of COVID-19, which, as you know, is just surging like wildfire. Would you back that kind of a short-term stay-at-home with some funding to support small businesses and individuals and local governments with the idea of, you know, saving the economy in the long run?
What I think is that there's already compromise legislation that's been brought forward for pandemic relief that we need to get, you know, settled and worked on and moved on before we bring new ideas to the table. I think to your other point, we're hopeful that total shutdowns are not inevitable. That when we had the big national shutdown, it's because we didn't know what worked. We didn't have testing, we didn't have tracing, we didn't have PPE. Our hope now is that if you had to have shutdowns, they could be targeted based on data. And it gets back to what you've said. We need to wear our masks. We need to get our flu shots. We need to socially distance because our economy can't take another shutdown. And as you well know, there's a big correlation between economic health and public health.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. You say the economy can't take another economic shutdown. The health of the country may not be able to take another surge. So it might be necessary to save lives, and in saving lives, save the economy in the long term. So we're not in this horrible wave of surges that come and go. It may be the only way to break out might be to shut down or do stay-at-homes in the short term. But just even your pushing of masks and social distancing and hand-washing and flu shots is something we're not hearing from this administration or from Republicans. And again, this is a traditionally conservative organization. This video is going through the progressive community like wildfire, you know, people in the local first community who haven't traditionally been aligned with the U.S. chambers. So you are reaching people maybe you hadn't previously reached, but you might reach the voices who have been resistant to this message of masks. And yet coming from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, they might listen.
It's just time for people to come together. We've had a chamber program called Path Forward that's been about navigating the return to health and the return to work. And we've had, really, to your point, an unusual for us audience of people paying attention. But Dr. Fauci said to me, we are going to get through this. The science is going to lead the way. But the private sector is going to get us there. And the private sector is playing a really important role in the development of therapeutics and the development of vaccines, et cetera. But also, I think, to your point, playing a role with small businesses across this country, some who are members and some aren't, that have been leading the way on mask wearing and on signage. I mean, we were having lots of take up on toolkits we put on our website that small businesses could download to put on their front doors that said, we're maintaining social distancing. We're asking you to wear a mask. We have hand sanitizer. We have sanitation in place. And what we say to people is, even if you don't believe in the science, that's okay. Do it for the grandma next to you in the store who you might be making uncomfortable. It's a moment just to be selfless.
Suzanne Clark, again, the president of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, something you said just jumped out at me. As Dr. Fauci said to me, you're talking to Dr. Anthony Fauci?
Mm-hmm. Of course, sure.
Well, you say that, but our president isn't talking to Dr. Fauci.
Oh, I mean, we've talked to the Surgeon General. I'm interviewing the head of the CDC tomorrow. When I say that we're hopeful you don't need a national shutdown again, I don't mean that we may not need targeted local shutdowns to stop the spread of this disease. But as you mentioned earlier, the situation on the ground is really different from one community to the next. So we need national guidelines. What is it we should be looking for? Is it hospitalization rates? Is it positivity rates? You know, national standards on what we can all pay attention to. And that type of guidance, that kind of transparency, would go a long way, I think, to creating confidence and credibility in the science.
Suzanne Clark, president of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
The CEOs of Facebook and Twitter are appearing virtually before Senate committee today to answer questions about their role policing misinformation during the 2020 elections. And while social media has been fertile ground for political messaging for years now, campaigns are increasingly turning to another platform to help them engage with young voters, Twitch. Democratic representatives Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ilhan Omar took to the live streaming service last month to play the popular video game Among Us with Hassan Piker, who has also become one of Twitch's top streamers by broadcasting progressive political commentary. Let's bring in Ben Brock Johnson. He covers tech for Here and Now and co-hosts the podcast Endless Thread. Hey, Ben.
Hi, Tanya.
Amazon bought Twitch for $970 million in cash back in 2014. There's a lot of money in it, and it's usually used by gamers. But what is Twitch exactly, and what do you usually watch on it?
Sure. Put simply, Twitch is how people watch other people play video games. And video games is a $30 billion annual industry, and there's been some really explosive growth in the audience and market for doing this stuff. Twitch currently has about 140 million monthly users. You can find about 1.5 million people watching at any time of the day. If you're watching a Twitch stream, you might be watching video of the player playing and also at the same time the video game being played and also at the same time watching a live chat happening. And yeah. It's kind of maddening, honestly. I don't know if you've ever watched a Twitch stream, Tanya, but it's a lot going on at the same time.
Yeah. But yeah, it does sound like there's a lot going on, but it's the way that young people engage in many ways, watching each other play games. It started off that way as friends watching each other, and now it's morphed into a whole platform.
Totally.
Do people actually pay to watch other people play video games? I mean, people make gobs of money from this, right?
Yeah, I mean, it depends a little bit on your definition of gobs, right? Twitch streamers can make money through advertisements, sponsorships, endorsements, and also just asking their viewers to give them tips or support them directly. Interestingly, Twitch has also been a place where pornography has popped up. Mm. That's been a policy issue for Twitch in the same way that it's been an issue for a lot of social media.
Yeah, it sounds like Twitch is undergoing many of the issues that many platforms, as you said, go through. But, you know, it's not just used for political use. The military is also recruiting on Twitch, correct?
Yeah. So this was a kind of an interesting story that's popped up over the last year or so. The Army and the Navy have both streamed on Twitch. They've also been dragged really hard for it by gamers. They've done some controversial things, trying to trick gamers into talking to recruiters. It's a little bit of a dicey area, but it is an area that the military is really interested in because of the kind of adjacency of warfare-themed video games and people that they might recruit, young people that they might recruit to join the military.
It sounds like it also depends on authenticity, maybe perception from Twitch users on what is an authentic building of community, or what is a community being built for some other type of purpose.
Absolutely. And I think that was the case with this recent game of Among Us, right? Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez blew up, in the Twitch stream. I think there were 400,000 viewers of the stream that she did with Mr. Piker. You know, that blew up, I think, because everyone playing was really comfortable in that space and using that platform. And people responded to that.
She's also somewhat of a superstar when it comes to lawmakers. And I'm also thinking about Hassan Piker because he's a top streamer on Twitch. But do we see this working in other ways? Are any Republicans doing this too?
Right. So that's a really interesting question. The short answer is yes. The Trump campaign has streamed rallies through the site. Conservative media streams on Twitch, there are some. And it's also been used as a way to re-platform people like Alex Jones, who have been banned or deplatformed by other social media companies. But in general, I would say not quite as much as progressives. Of course, at the same time, the video game world writ large has definitely been a place of rampant racism, sexism, homophobia, transphobia, xenophobia, othering in so many ways, right? But at the same time, video games can also be a world in which people are permitted to be who they want to be and be allowed to be who they are. It can be a form of entertainment that is democratized and resistant to gatekeeping. And I think it's fair to say that a lot of gamers actually align with the more liberal politics of some of these popular streamers as well. So I don't know if we can identify the impact of Twitch right now on actual votes, but it just really is interesting to see Twitch as a kind of new form of media. You know, streamers like Hassan Piker and there's another streamer called Destiny, they're kind of their own form of nightly news or talk radio. If you watch their stuff, there's this like very informal, jokey, irreverent vibe. Like they're swearing, they're making video game references, etc. But at the very same time, they're actually engaging in super intense political commentary and discussion with their followers and viewers. And those followers and viewers are young. They're people that both political parties really want to access, right, to win elections. So it'll be interesting to see how that kind of plays out in the coming elections, coming years.
Absolutely. That's Ben Brock Johnson, senior producer and co-host of Endless Thread. Thank you so much, Ben.
Thank you, Tanya.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.